and surpassed, penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. Hearing all of that wonderful teaching in the litany and the invocations for Nagarjuna is really very humbling. And what I would like to talk about is how is it that we can recognize and take refuge in what we already know to be true in our own hearts. So what I'm going to say today is actually inspired by talking to a lot of you. I am always impressed and have really been reflecting on this in recent months, how when people talk about their training, or just in conversation, how often it is that we will be able to go right to what the issue is, know what it is we need to do, and then kind of go right by it. Go right by it. I have been struck by how many times I have heard myself say, and I certainly could be wrong, but I hear myself say over and over again, wait a minute, did you hear what you just said? Because I think that's the heart of it right there. Did you hear that? And there's somehow then there could be a moment of recognition. Oh, okay, or you know, that feels... It feels like something that that feels right, it feels true. So if I can just see if I can explore this whole matter a bit this morning. I had an experience of this often when I go on retreat. With any luck, a theme will emerge, something just springs up naturally, and I can then have the time to study and reflect on it. And a while back, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to go on retreat. And this time, the theme arose before I even got to the hermitage. I stopped at a grocery store, and I thought I was just going to nip in and buy a few things. An hour and a half later, I was still there because I was so overwhelmed by the proliferation of things that were being offered that I became absolutely transfixed as I was standing in the aisle there. And I was seeing, you know, because of all the things that are being added to everything nowadays. So, you know, things have antioxidants, they have hot sauce, they have spices, they have aloe. There are all variations on the original product. And the thing is, even with the orange juice, I thought this is going to be simple, but then I was forced to have to decide whether I wanted calcium in it or not. And then did I want fruit pulp or not? And so the thing that just came up really clearly to me was go back to the original product. Go back to what you know. So I looked for the thing that said original. You know what I mean? And there's usually one. Go back to what you know. Go back to what you can trust. Go back to what you have confidence in. Go back to what has worked. And this, of course, is true in our spiritual life. And we all know this. We all know it. And so the question for me is, what is it that pulls us out of our ability to actually recognize it, to remember it, to go back to it? And because in Buddhism, we're not going out to find anything. We are not going out to find something. The Buddha did that for us. And he came back and he told us that what we needed was within us and we could all find it. And all of the great masters since his time have confirmed that for us, including our own master, Reverend Master Jiu, our founder, whose book, if you remember, Zen is Eternal Life, the original title was Selling Water by the River. And that's what she used to say, you know, I'm selling water by the river. Now, in Dogen's rules for meditation, he says, it's futile to travel to other dusty countries, thus forsaking your own seat. If your first step is false, you will immediately stumble. And, you know, that phrase is one that I think most people remember out of his rules for meditation. If we don't remember anything else, that one stands out. It's futile to travel to other dusty countries, thus forsaking your own seat. Already you have the attributes of a human being. Do not waste time with this and that. You can possess the authority of Buddha. So we can know the Buddha's truth for ourselves. Now, of course, traveling isn't the problem. There isn't any problem about traveling. It's the forsaking your own seat. As you know, we can forsake our own seat as soon as we get off of it in the meditation hall. So it's a figurative forsaking our own seat, really abandoning ourselves, ignoring what we already know, leaving our place of refuge. And this is how Reb Anderson, in his book Being Upright, which is a book he wrote on the Bodhisattva precepts, has this way of expressing it. When I take refuge in Buddha, which is our own hearts, I don't take refuge in my good points or my skillful behavior. And of course, I don't take refuge in my shortcomings. I take refuge in me being me. This is my indestructible virtue, which is never lost, except by me forgetting it or by not facing up to it. To take refuge means to give up running away from home. I love that idea. Running away from home. How much time do we spend running away from home? It means to recognize my responsibility to live in accord with my Buddhahood. We all have a large reservoir of innate wisdom, which is at the heart of our Buddha nature. We just heard some lovely invocations and teaching on great wisdom. How do we cultivate it? How do we recognize it? How do we nourish it? Many people talk to us about their distress and dismay and despair about our political, economic, military situation, about the state of the environment. And some people feel it's going to take a miracle to bring about some kind of change. But actually, you know, what would it be like if it was just each of us acting on what we already know to be true? Right now, just acting on what we know to be true. Our former abbot, Reverend Echo, once said in a lecture, what would it be like if everybody in the world, just for one day, kept the five precepts? Not killing, not stealing, not lying, not indulging in sexual misconduct, not taking intoxicants. Now, if we just think about that, everybody in the world did that just for one day, what would that be like? It brings this whole matter into the realm of possibility, doesn't it? And it kind of points out that the ball is in our court, right? They're taking responsibility for what we already know is true and acting on it. So that's a lot easier said than done. But I wanted just to mention a few of our teachings, things that we already know that I think can be very helpful to us if we perhaps just broaden our view of them a bit. And the first one, of course, is meditation. Now, if you have trouble meditating, your heart can sink when I say this. And I can remember when I was a lay trainee in Berkeley and going to the Priory there and just learning how to meditate. And one of the other lay trainees was there. We were talking to the prior it was a class, and so the prior said to this fellow, you've told me you've got some problems with meditation. This would be a really good time for us to talk about it. And this fellow said, oh, I don't have any problems with it. He said, I just can't do it. Okay, he's now one of the senior monks in our order, so... You can see he had to work his way through a lot, but it's very encouraging, actually. I love remembering that little interchange those many years ago. And the meditation, of course, is what lays the groundwork for us. It is our anchor that we can return to throughout the day, throughout the day. So, if you feel like you don't have time to do it, or you're discouraged because you feel that you have trouble doing it, or perhaps you're saying to yourself, I still can't do it after all these years, and some people say, I just had let my meditation practice drop away, it was too difficult, I was really just, it was just too painful. So the question is, what is it that's going to help us here? And, I remember what Reverend Master Jiyu said down there in Berkeley in one of her talks to a woman who said, boy, I'd really like to meditate. I've got five kids. And she said, can you sit on the edge of your bed when you get up in the morning for 30 seconds? How many times in our growing up did we hear teachers, parents tell us to just quiet down, just sit still. So we all know how to do that, regardless of what we think about our ability to do, what we think of as meditation. We all know how to be still. We all know how to quiet down. Reverend Master Jiyu used to say that the advantage of learning how to meditate while sitting on a chair is that it is a reminder that you can do it any place. You don't have to have any gear with you. You can do it on a park bench. You can do it when you're sitting in the waiting room in a doctor's office. You can do it in a restaurant while you're waiting to be served. And this is a lovely piece that she has in The Roar of the Tigress in the first volume. She says, so you don't necessarily have to sit physically in front of a wall to do this. What you really want to do is make your mind sit, to put it still. I've often told people who say they haven't time to meditate each morning because they have to go to work and the like, that's fine, sit on the bus or the commuter train or whatever method you're using of travel, as if your hands were in the gassho. And then she used this image that she used to love to use, put the two halves of your brain together. Still, sit still in the mind of stillness and just leave them there for 5 minutes or 2 minutes or 50 seconds. I don't care how long, just make the effort of doing it. And you can see in so many of our pictures of Reverend Master Jiyu, she's making gassho. So she says, every one of us, every hour of the day, has a few minutes when we can stop still and hear the silence within ourselves. And it is in those silent stillnesses that you will teach the mind to sit. You need formal meditation. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying you should not sit in meditation. You should. I'm talking about the person who says, I haven't got the time. All right, make your mind sit. And when you have the time, physically sit. She always made you want to do it. She could talk about the practice in such a way that she just made you want to do it. Because for her, it was so alive, just full of life and vibrance and purpose. Now, actually, I'm here today because many years ago I saw somebody sit still in what was for me a very difficult situation. I've told some of you this story, but I'm going to take the liberty of telling it again because I think it's so much to the point here. I was, this was a situation at work when I was a lay trainee, and I was working in a hospital setting, and there had been a lot of budget cuts, so there was an administrative meeting in which these cuts were being discussed, and some of them were raising a lot of agitation. The one that I remember the best was that the therapists were being asked to bring the Kleenex for their own counseling sessions. I don't think the hospital saved a lot of money on this, but anyway, there was a feeling of just, you know, frustration and irritation and whatnot going on in this meeting. It was very difficult, and back then I had even less restraint on my opinions than I do now. So I was, and really no wisdom in terms of when it was appropriate to offer them. So I was really having a very difficult time. And I happened to look down at this long table I was sitting at, and I saw one of my colleagues at the other end of the table, and he was just sitting perfectly still. He didn't say a word throughout this whole discussion. He sat there, he looked perfectly at ease. And I thought to myself, how is it possible that somebody can sit through this and not get all, you know, I didn't have the distance to see that I was all wrought up. But how could somebody sit through this and not feel they had to get in there and do something? And a little bit later, the light bulb went off, and I thought, ah, there is another way. There is another way. Because actually, I so much really wanted to be able to sit still. And this man was helping me do that. And, you know, this is absolute proof of that thing that you hear us say when we are doing our own training, it benefits other people. This man did not set out to help me. He was just doing whatever he was doing. But what he was doing was an enormous help to me. So back in the 70s, I remember there was a great ad for V8 juice. the health movement was just getting started, and this ad on TV, a woman in some kind of stressful situation at work goes over to, take a breather or help herself out, goes to get a soda at a vending machine, which we all knew was an unwholesome choice. She drinks it down, she looks at the camera straight in the eye, and she says, "Oh, I could have had a V8. Now for me, somehow that slogan just really was something that I found enormously helpful, not because of the V8, but because when I would come out of a really difficult situation, which I realized immediately that I hadn't handled very well, I would think to myself, "Oh, I could have been meditating." And to this very day, I walk away from things, you know, with this kind of review of what I was just up to going on in my mind and thinking, "I could have been meditating. I could have quieted down, just gotten into a still place, and then responded." So we learn to act from a place of stillness. We can learn to do that. We can learn to act in harmony with our Buddha nature. Our meditation is our most powerful practice. It is our most powerful tool to help us with that. And there are many, many different ways of doing it. So coming back to what we already know. Another one of Reverend Master Jiyu's favorite stories that I remember was about a Zen master who was trying to give some teaching to a very simple farmer. And this man really couldn't follow his instructions and didn't understand what it was the Zen master was getting to. So finally, the Zen master says to him, "I'll give you a mantra. You just recite it throughout the day. Recite it throughout the day when you're doing your work. And whenever you think of it, just come back to doing this mantra." And he told him to recite Om Mane Padme Hum. And then he said to him, "You know, why don't you do that for 6 months or so, and then come back and tell me how it's going." So a year later, the farmer comes back and starts talking to the Zen master, and it's very clear to the Zen master that this man has had an awakening experience. And he says to him, "Well, what have you been doing?" And the farmer says, "Well, I've been reciting that mantra you gave me." The Zen master can't remember what it is, so he says, "Well, what was the mantra?" And the farmer says, "Om Mane Padme Ox." He went back to what he knew. He went back to what he knew, to what he trusted. And because his faith was strong, his intention was pure, his heart opened. So, you know, all these, I think it's helpful nowadays to think about these kind of things, because with the proliferation of information available to us nowadays, right? We can be worried about how much we know or don't know, how much we think we need to know before we can do anything about ourselves or about our practice or about practically anything, really, because of the constant bombardment of information coming our way and the suggestion that we really need this, that, or the other. So it's very helpful to just come back to the original, come back to what we already know. So something else I would like to talk about is patience. And we talk about this all the time, so you're going to have to be patient with me today if I bring it up again. Because I am impressed by how many people say they have a real problem with impatience. And after all my many years of training, I am also one of those people. And you know, we all grew up hearing about it from our parents. I certainly did. My parents used to try to talk to my sister and I all the time about being patient. But of course, you know, that was Mom, so how helpful could that be? We never took it seriously. And so imagine my surprise years later when I learned this is a spiritual practice. You know, in Buddhism, it's one of the paramitas. It's one of the rafts that takes us to the other shore. One of my favorite things that I have read that the Buddha said is the practice of patience is the highest austerity. It's a great relief, isn't it, to know this is a very difficult practice. Out of all the things that he did, all of his ascetic practices, after years of training, he said the practice of patience is the highest austerity. He also said, patient endurance is the supreme practice for turning the heart from unwholesome states. It's pretty important. Now, Ajahn Chah, died some years back, was one of the great Theravadin forest monks in the Thai tradition. And it is said that when somebody came to him with the problem, the first thing he would say to them is, well, can you endure it? And I thought, well, now, isn't that interesting? This is a question we can ask ourselves. Our tendency usually is to get in there and want to, you know, sort of move things around so that we don't really have to live with this. And so his first question, can you endure it? So, again, this is not a toe-tapping, waiting something out. When is this going to be over? This isn't patience, actually, you know. I mean, it's good, it's probably a good step, but it isn't actually patience because it doesn't give us any peace of heart. And I came across this little piece on patience, again by one of the forest monks, Ajahn Nayanarato. And what he has to say about it, I found very helpful. He said, in our modern world, we want to see results as quickly as possible. There's constant pressure to keep up with the latest advances, together with a fear of being left behind. In this context, patience is one of the key qualities we need to recognize more consciously. Often we see patience as old-fashioned. Now, isn't that true? I mean, when you think about it, people don't name their kids patience anymore. Old-fashioned, I thought that's exactly it. In the modern world, in the world of the internet, and speeded up everything, patience is old-fashioned. He says it looks the opposite of keeping pace with the world. But if we are to find a way to live together peacefully, the virtue of patience is essential. And then he says, how are we when we are patient? How is the state of the body, the mind? Is it simply negative? And then he says, or is it the moment of being nourished, the moment of regaining our strength? Now, isn't that an interesting kind of view to bring to the matter when you are wanting to be patient? Can you see it as this, use this time as a moment to be nourished, to regain your strength? The moment we are patient, we gain inner strength, and more importantly, it leads us to realize that very moment is complete in itself. Nothing is missing. So I found that to be something to reflect on. I hope I will remember it. So the last thing I wanted to mention is our recognition of our profound interconnection with all beings, with all living things, with everything, really. Certainly this theme was reflected in the teachings that we heard this morning during the ceremony. And it manifests itself in a lot of different ways. I recently had the opportunity to visit Stout Grove, which is a grove of old growth redwoods up in the Jedediah Smith Redwood Park. These incredible old beings, bigger than anything that you could possibly imagine. And there were a lot of people there. Reverend Master Ondo and I were on retreat at our hermitage in Northern California, and there were a lot of people there, and we were thinking we could hardly find a place to park. The minute we got out of the car, we had a sense of being in a sacred space. The silence and the stillness of these trees was so palpable that all of the people who were there were so reverent and respectful in this place. It had a sense of, we all were just kind of tuned into the fact that there was certainly something bigger here that we were all part of. And it was humbling. It was humbling. And I was really grateful to have that kind of way of connecting both with my fellow beings and these big trees. And then it seems that insects have played a great role here in my life here in the past few weeks in a variety of ways, but really offering teaching. We had an introductory retreat, and the Dharma talk that I was asked to do was on the precepts, and I told some stories about insects and not killing them and what we can learn from them. I've told this story before, I think, too, but I think it's just such a helpful and encouraging story. We had some years back, a young woman come to a retreat. Her mother had been here before and found it very helpful coming to an introductory retreat. And she had been having a very difficult time. She'd been having a really rough time. And at the end of the retreat, I asked her how it went. And she said, I saw the tallest monk in the monastery lean down to pick up a caterpillar that was on the cloister to prevent it from getting stepped on. she said, and it gave me hope. And, you know, again, that is that incredible recognition of how we are all interconnected. It's a cross-species affair, isn't it? I was just reading something about, I get, the alumni, I was looking in an alumni magazine. I like to find out what kind of research, what the young folk are up to nowadays. What are people doing in the universities? What are they interested in? What are they studying? And I discovered that there is a field which, you know, you may already know about, but this insect neuroscience. And what it is the study of insects applied to humans in a myriad of ways, in a myriad of helpful ways. One young woman is studying the caterpillar during metamorphosis to see how what she's learning from that can be applied in the treatment of Alzheimer's and muscular dystrophy. I learned that the venom from scorpions is being experimented with to treat brain cancer. Now, you know, the thing that's also so amazing to me is that the similarity of our biology is such that you can have these kind of cross treatments at work. Whether we want to think about it or not, whether we like the idea or not, we're all related. We're all related to all of these beings. No matter how we feel about them, there is this underlying connection. Oh, I kind of got derailed there because I wanted to tell something else that happened at this introductory retreat. Last week I had told some stories about insects, as I said, and now I was talking to a retreat guest afterwards who gave me permission to use this story that he told me. Because we were talking about the fact that, you know, it was close to going back home. He's thinking about what he's learned here and how he can apply it when he goes back home. And he was telling me that his son, who's in his late 20s, is moving back home for a while. And he was feeling some... what's the word we want to use here? Some anxiety as the arising of some old tensions and difficulties, you know, were arising in terms of having the kids back home. And as he was talking about this, he said, you know, I remember when my son was about 3 or 4 years old, he said, I noticed that he would very carefully pick up any insects in the house, very gently take them out one by one, very carefully, very gently. And he said, you know, when he moved back in, I happened to look over my shoulder one day when we were both in the same room. I saw him, he's still doing it. And then he looked at me and he smiled and he laughed, he said, you know, it took me 56 years and a trip to the monastery to learn what my son knew when he was 3 years old. And his concern about his son and how it was going to be just kind of dissipated. Now the thing is, I don't think that this man had to come up here to learn it, but I think he had to come here to recognize what he already knew. And that's the talk for today. Thank you.